Hello, and welcome to Candid with Mathilde. I'm your host, Mathilde Bechet. It's a challenging time for everyone worldwide. The COVID-19 pandemic altered lives in a matter of months. At this point, you might be avoiding news regarding this subject, and I don't blame you. It's overwhelming, but we will get through this together. And if you're feeling like there's no light at the end of the tunnel, history shows us that we have overcome much worse. So stick around to learn about another global pandemic that happened 100 years ago. This episode will be diving into the media coverage of a global health catastrophe that emerged at the same time as World War I, the 1918 influenza pandemic, also known as the Spanish flu. According to the CDC, it took the lives of almost 50 million people around the globe, including 675,000 in the United States alone. Specifically, we'll dive into media coverage of the pandemic from 1918 until 1919, in hopes of understanding whether or not media outlets were effective in warning individuals in our country. We'll have three renowned historians who will provide insight into the scope of this outbreak. They will also draw parallels between the media coverage of the influenza and the modern coverage of COVID-19, seeing if history is doomed to repeat itself or not. Our first guest holds numerous titles. He's a best-selling author, historian, educator, the list goes on and on. His celebrated book, Don't You Know Much About History, spent 35 consecutive weeks on the New York Times bestseller list. In 2018, he released More Deadly Than War, The Hidden History of the Spanish Flu and the First World War. Please welcome Kenneth C. Davis. The first thing I'll ask you is, what prompted you to write this book?
It's a perfectly good and sensible question. I have been writing about American history for 30 years, and I've always tried to focus on what I call the stories that the school books leave out, the pieces of American history that are too important to ignore. And for much of that time, it was stories about women and Black Americans and Native Americans, the stories that certainly weren't in my school books. And then a few years ago, I happened to be having a casual conversation with my editor at the publishing house, who had the flu and somehow got onto the Spanish flu. And she said, you know, my grandmother died from it. I don't know much about it. I'd really be interested if you ever wanted to write about that. And that was really the birth of the book. But it does fall in perfectly into this category of stories that our school books left out. Because until recently, I would say the vast majority of Americans had never heard of the Spanish flu. Even when I published the book, More Deadly Than War, which came out 2 years ago, most people still hadn't heard of it. It's really only since this pandemic and a lot of media attention given to the Spanish flu, the most deadly pandemic before this, that most people even heard of it.
So the term Spanish flu actually in itself, it's contradicting because a lot of people assume that originated from Spain, given the term the Spanish flu, but that wasn't the case. So why was this pandemic known as the Spanish flu?
It's a really good and important question, and it gets to the heart of why I wrote this book the way I did and called it More Deadly Than War, because it's completely connected to World War I. And you can't understand the Spanish flu without understanding World War I, and you can't understand the last year of World War I in a way without understanding the Spanish flu. So they're completely connected. The connection in this case is that Spain was neutral during World War I. It was not fighting. One of the European countries that had nothing to do with what's going on. As a neutral nation, the Spanish did not censor the newspapers. Most other countries that were combatants, including the United States, censored newspapers to a degree, and newspapers were self-censoring to a degree. Newspapers were willingly kind of keeping this news out of the front pages. One, they didn't want to cause panic, ostensibly what they said. They didn't certainly want to hurt business, which would then hurt advertising. On a national level, the governments wanted to suppress this news because, again, not to create panic, also not to let the enemy know that they had been weakened by the flu, and also to keep people doing what they were doing, which in the United States meant going into the army to fight, going to factories that were producing all the materials of war. So this was part of the war effort, was to suppress this information. Spain didn't censor its newspapers. So the first report of a real mass epidemic in Europe comes out of Madrid, where the king is sick and the situation is so bad they actually shut down the public transportation in Madrid. And because of that report coming out, was picked up in the British press, massive epidemic in Madrid, it became known as the Spanish influenza, the Spanish lady sometimes, or simply the Spanish flu. But the Germans called it the Bolshevik fever. Russians called it the Chinese fever. Different countries called it different things. And so we've seen that in this situation, the politicization of calling this COVID the Chinese flu, the Chinese fever, Kung flu. The president has used a variety of disparaging names, of course, to politicize what should be known by its scientific name.
So talking about how deadly this influenza was and the scope of this outbreak, estimates claim that Spanish influenza killed more than 15 million people during World War I. But can you paint a picture of the scope of this number?
These numbers are very much estimates. And what used to be an estimate of maybe 20 or 25 million people gradually has crept up over time. 50 million is now kind of the low number of that estimate. It goes as high as 100 million. The estimate in the United States is a little bit more specific and perhaps worth noting here. 675,000 Americans died of the Spanish flu and flu complications in a little more than a year. This is basically something that starts in March of 1918. The real deadly outbreak is in the fall of 1918. Again, a slack off returns in the winter into the early spring of 1919 and continues for quite a while. Now, 675,000 Americans is an extraordinary number.
We're going to shift gears now and talk a bit more about the media coverage during the influenza period. I stumbled upon this next guest's political article while researching this topic. The piece was published over the summer under the title Rampant Lies, Fake Cures, and Not Enough Beds: What the Spanish Flu Debate Can Teach Us About Coronavirus. Now, its author is here with us. Joining the conversation is celebrated historian, New York Times best-selling author, and contributing editor at Political Magazine, Joshua Zeitz.
One of the lessons I want to talk about is specifically the media coverage of this pandemic during that time. Extreme censorship, intimidation. It was a downplaying of the severity of the virus, especially those countries who were involved in the war. How did it impact U.S. society? The newspapers were the number one resource of information. And compared to now, there's mass information. It's impossible to hide the truth. But at that time, people depended on newspapers and them downplaying the severity, that had an impact in our society. So could you talk about that?
The media environment then and now is in some ways strikingly different and in some ways remarkably the same. What's different is that the early 20th century, you had a huge profusion of local and state and national media outlets. So most cities had a couple of newspapers and not radio stations at that point, but a city like New York or Boston or Philly would have like 5-6 competing newspapers, afternoon papers, evening papers, morning papers. That same pattern repeated itself in the 20s and 30s and 40s when you got the advent of radio and television. Today, because of a number of reasons, the traditional media has been dying and is dying quickly. And so most states only have a handful of daily newspapers. They only have a handful of independent radio and television news sources. That's different. However, what's replaced those vehicles? Social media. So it's distribution platforms like Twitter and Facebook and YouTube. And what's similar between then and now is that the kind of media channels have been an enormous source of disinformation. If you look at the types of reporting and also just the advertising that you would encounter in local and daily newspapers in 1918-19, they were tons of advertisements for and articles about sham medicines that were presumably purportedly cure the Spanish flu, things that you could take, things that you could swallow, clothes that you could wear to protect yourself. It was all a sham, obviously. You also saw an enormous amount of anti-mask journalism in 1918-19.
According to a recent article by Time, quote, in some cases, businesses took advantage of public fears and desperation about the crisis, even when their products didn't seem relevant, end quote. It's mind-blowing that such information wasn't even approved by doctors or supported by science.
When talking about the coverage of this back then in 1918, I found that there were commercial advertisements and newspapers that Red Cross had published in terms of wearing masks and just emphasizing the need for hygiene and washing hands. And there was also a great deal of misinformation. How does that compare with what's going on today? Because if you think about it, back then, the low number of advertisements they had in terms of pushing for masks, in today's time, in the beginning of the pandemic of COVID-19, people were saying, oh, you shouldn't really wear masks if you're healthy. What similarities and differences do you see?
Red Cross was very important. There was no government, national, federal effort the way we would think of a CDC. When this flu pandemic begins, in fact, nobody's even reporting the fact that there are flu cases. That didn't happen until well into September of 1918. That the Public Health Service started to require doctors to report flu cases. This is one of the reasons, again, why information about numbers is so difficult at that time. You almost have to go back and look at death certificates and insurance records to see how many people actually died. So that's one aspect of it. The government at that time was much more interested in the war effort and keeping people going to their factories, sending men to the front, than they were in public health and protecting Americans. So there was no massive federal effort to, say, wear masks, socially distance. And even today, of course, we've gotten very, very confusing messages from the leadership of the country on those things. In a very, very dangerous way, I would be quick to say. The other thing is, speaking of advertisements, and when you mention that, is that much more common than public service type advertisements about wearing masks were the advertisements for fake cures. Yes. Newspapers were filled with all kind of quack cures, people putting out things, and we've, of course, seen that in our own time as well. People are always eager and willing to make a buck from a disaster. And newspapers were, of course, happy to publish advertisements for anything without worrying about whether it was accurate or true or not. Certainly in 1918, the standards of advertising were far, far lower than they might be today. So that's another important point from a journalistic perspective. Yes.
We're now bringing in our final guest to the conversation, Dr. J. Alexander Navarro, the diplomatic, political, and intellectual historian. In 2005, Dr. Navarro was a member of the team of medical historians from the University of Michigan Medical School Center in charge of researching the historical, social, economic, and political effects of the 1918 Spanish influenza. This research was commissioned by the Defense Department during the 2005 Bush administration in hopes of gaining a clearer understanding of the various prevention methods that could be used to combat possible outbreaks. According to the report, the study looked into, quote, NPI, short for non-pharmaceutical interventions implemented to prevent or contain the pandemic influenza in the continental United States. It may come as a surprise to you, and it did with me, but measures we've been employing today, like isolating, quarantining, social distancing, and mask wearing, all came from the study published 15 years prior to COVID.
We were first asked in 2005, 2006 to study it for the Defense Department. They wanted to know if there were things that communities did in 1918 to actually prevent, not just lower the cases and deaths, but actually prevent influenza from entering those communities. They'd heard that there were these escape communities. And so we studied that, and it turns out there were a handful of them. There's a famous one, or kind of an urban legend, it turned out to be true, was Gunnison, Colorado. The entire county barricaded itself from the outside world for a number of months in the fall of 1918.
This leads us into exploring the argument that our government and newspapers at the time censored influenza information because of the ongoing war.
I think that there has been a lot made by a few people about this supposed censorship in the press when it relates to the influenza epidemic of 1918. I would put a slightly different spin on it. Some people have said that, and in particular, one author, John Barry, has made this big argument that the federal government lied to people lied to the American public and censored newspapers. And it's not really true. I think what was really going on is the overlap of several issues. First of all, at the federal level, this was before people looked to the federal government for a national response to any kind of national crisis. As we know now, public health was then and is today largely the domain of state and local government. Since the Great Depression, the advent of the New Deal legislation, and then certainly since the creation of the CDC in 1946, when it comes to public health, I think we expect a larger federal role than people did in 1918. The reason that Wilson, for example, didn't say anything about the pandemic in 1918 wasn't because he was lying to the American public. It was because the epidemic control measures were largely state and local, and also because he was busy worrying about World War I.
That's an interesting take, actually, because I feel like most of the journalists or the articles I've been reading about, even you mentioned John Barry, it's been more about the government withheld this information from the public and the media played a really big role in choosing not to cover it. But I never thought about that aspect of it. So that was interesting that you brought it up. Zeitz, what are your thoughts on this argument?
I think that's a very good point. I mean, the federal government 100 years ago was minuscule relative to what it is today, and it largely had no authority over or ability to impact things like public health, K-12 education, probably higher education, transportation. I mean, it was a much different framework before the New Deal era than what it is today. So that is certainly true. That having been said, there were periods in American history when the federal government played an enormous role in these areas, and they usually were times of war or crisis. If you look at the Civil War, that's probably the first moment when the federal government played an enormous role in influencing public health life. And so in theory, federal government could have taken this more seriously in 1918, 1919. But for a number of reasons, it pulled back and it didn't involve itself aggressively. And you had a bunch of disinformation and just non-information flowing from the highest levels of government in Washington.
There seems to be a general consensus among Davis, Zeitz, and you, Dr. Navarro, that we should keep in mind that media developments that have occurred should be considered when drawing parallels.
When we say the media in 1918, we're largely talking about newspaper. Mm-hmm. And to some extent, magazines, right? Print periodicals. The media, quote unquote, the media today is so multifaceted that mm-hmm. it's nowhere near as monolithic as it was. It wasn't monolithic in 1918, but it's certainly not anywhere near as monolithic today. And so I think it really depends. So in terms of how the media is doing, if we want to compare and contrast it, media coverage in 1918 was largely top down. It was newspaper reports on the mayor said this, the health officer said this. There was a meeting of the Board of Health yesterday that said this. Here's the case tallies. Here's the death toll. Here's how many people are in hospitals. They're opening up this field hospital, et cetera. It was sort of a macro level top down. It wasn't so much how is this impacting the man or woman on the street. Mm-hmm. There was some of that. We did see that in places like Chicago, for example, but those newspaper articles were fairly far between. Today, there's so much more coverage. We have print coverage, we have digital coverage, we have local news stations, we have cable news, and of course we have misinformation and disinformation spread by a whole host of pseudo media outlets, as well as, you know, let's be blunt about it, outlets like Fox News. And so it's really hard to say, to sort of compare and contrast. The big difference is, as I said earlier, the response wasn't, and therefore the media coverage was not politicized in 1918 the way it is today. I think that generally speaking, at least the media coverage that I watch has been pretty good about covering how deadly this pandemic is today, how serious it is, the need to follow public health dictates and to follow good science.
Zeitz, something that really interested me in the article is when you mentioned how professional historians often say that history is bound to repeat itself. Yet in this case, you stated that it really isn't. So I was just wondering if you could delve into why you said such thing.
This well-worn phrase, history is bound to repeat itself, and I think a lot of people feel that that's a smart way of opening an argument. It really isn't. When historians look at the inputs that help produce a certain set of outcomes, there's contingency, the kind of randomness of mm-hmm. human history. There are broader structural forces like economic change or social or environmental change. There are a whole bunch of inputs that go into determining a particular output or outcome. I think historians don't really believe that history repeats itself. There are no broad patterns. There are no broad kind of repetitious elements. However, sometimes countries or institutions, people do actually commit the same errors, the same fallacies. And in this particular case, there's a whole lot of overlap between what we saw in 1918, 1919, and what we're seeing today in 2020 with COVID. So it is one of these rare occasions where, as an historian, I actually feel comfortable saying that we are actually repeating history. And it's unfortunate because you can actually learn from past mistakes. mistakes or past patterns.
And do you think we're learning from past patterns, or is, in your opinion, we're just repeating the same mistakes all over again now?
I think we're repeating the same mistakes. I identified a couple in the article that I think are salient. First of all, in 1918, you had public officials who just were not leveling with the American people. And I'm only looking at the US because that's what I know as a US historian. There was almost no communication from Woodrow Wilson's administration to the public about the pandemic. In part, that was because the Wilson administration was focused exclusively on the Versailles Treaty and the sort of fallout of World War I. They simply weren't interested in were equipped to address the pandemic. That having been said, the federal health authorities lied pretty brazenly to the American public about the severity of the flu, its origins, and the need for measures to contain it. You also had public health officials at the state and local levels who were equally dishonest with the public. So there's a lot of that that you see today as well, particularly from the Trump administration.
And I'm not sure if this will be ending on a positive note, but I just want to get your thoughts on where you think our country's heading.
I think that what we're seeing right now is that we have two parallel media landscapes that are completely isolated from each other. On one side, you have media organizations that are traditional and attempting to investigate and analyze and convey information in what they say is an objective way. And there's a good debate about whether there's anything such as objectivity, but they're making a good faith effort at it. And then you have this vast right-wing media empire that began, I would say, in the 1950s, 60s with newsletters. Letters and alternative print publications, really kind of scaled up during the 1980s with talk radio, and then found its voice in a big way in the 1990s with Rupert Murdoch's Fox empire. Mm-hmm. And that has been very savvy about leveraging social media. And I couldn't tell you, there are people looking at this, what percentage of Americans mainly derive their news from those sources, but they are unfortunately being really ill-served. They're being fed pseudoscience and all what Kellyanne Conway would call alternative facts. And it's a scary thing because politically, we have about 25-30% of the country that exists in its own media bubble that bears little relationship to the kind of objective fact set the rest of the country consumes. And then when you get something like COVID-19, you see where that can really become dangerous. You have the whole Rupert Murdoch organization telling people that they don't have to wear masks, that they don't have to shut things down, that they can hold events inside together, close to each other. You see this message being propagated on otherwise neutral platforms like Facebook and YouTube, and it becomes very dangerous. And you literally get a super spreader White House. So it's troubling. And I think that no matter what happens with the current election, and well after we get a vaccine that's widely distributed for COVID, the real question is, how do you maintain a civil society where a good 25-30% of the country simply opted out of objective journalism? That's really, really frightening. COVID has placed it in sharp relief, but it's a problem that will well outlast COVID as a public health issue.
What is your take on this, Dr. Navarro?
We're doing a terrible job of handling this pandemic. By any and all metrics, we're doing a terrible job. And we've done so pretty much from the beginning, at least nationally. There were some states that acted quicker than others. New York got caught really hard. New York, I'm from New Jersey, New Jersey as well, got caught really hard. The same happened in 1918. It's going to spread in more densely populated urban areas and states. However, we still see people debating, are we in the first wave, second wave, third wave? We're in the third spike of the first wave here. The case counts and the death tallies increase. Now, the light at the end of the tunnel is that, like all previous pandemics in human history, this too will end, but it doesn't have to, and it hasn't had to be as bad in the United States as it's been. So just because it's going to end at some point doesn't mean we just say, well, just let the thing rip and whoever survives, survives. I think that we should be at a point in our human development and certainly our national history where we're better than that and we learn the lessons of the past.
Well, that's it for this episode. We've listened to three experts who've each provided their perspective on the Spanish flu. It seems that you as a listener can determine, based on this information, whether or not media outlets were effective in warning individuals in our country. Please feel free to email me at MathildeBechet@gmail.com. Mathilde, M-A-T-I-L-D-E, Bechet, B-E-C-H-E-T, with any questions or comments on this episode. Thank you for sticking around. Remember, stay safe and wear a mask.